Well, a heartbreaking day for the Lansing Fire Department yesterday. I'm sure many Current State listeners have the department in their thoughts here today. Following the death of 35-year-old Dennis Rodman yesterday afternoon, he was struck and hit by a hit-and-run driver, killed. The 22-year-old driver is under arrest after a police chase. Lansing Police Captain Jim Krause said there was some type of traffic altercation before Mr. Rodman was struck by the driver's pickup truck. Krause said the driver, quote, was upset for whatever reason, unquote, and that a preliminary investigation shows, again quoting, he deliberately hit the firefighter who was standing in the road collecting for charity, unquote. Rodman was participating in an annual fundraising campaign for the Muscular Dystrophy Association and the International Association of Firefighters, as if this is not heartbreaking enough, when he was struck by the car. Impressive guy, did a tour as a Marine in Iraq, according to the Lansing State Journal, a newlywed with a child on the way. Sad news from Lance. Sad and infuriating at the same time. It's Current State here on WKAR. Welcome back. I'm Mark Bayshore. Income inequality is coming up regularly in the long buildup to next year's presidential election. There is evidence that income inequality has risen in the United States, some say noticeably, since the 1970s. The issue has gone on to become a feature of the political divide in the country, with the left insisting on the importance of a shared prosperity, while the right often downplays the need or the ability to influence the issue. So how does Michigan fit in the income inequality debate? That's what MSU economics professor Charlie Ballard recently explored. We welcome him back to Current State. It's good to see you.
Thanks for having me.
This project focused on income distribution. What were you trying to find out exactly?
Well, you're absolutely right that nationally there has been a huge increase in income inequality since the middle to late 1970s, so almost 40 years now of increasing inequality, with the top pulling away from the middle and the bottom. But what hasn't been studied as much, and what I and my colleague Paul Menchik have been looking at, is How does it look in the different regions of the country, in different states? And so we've actually calculated the change in different places in the income distribution for all 50 states and the District of Columbia. Well, for the U.S. as a whole, the bottom and the middle have done so-so, and the top has done really, really well in the last 40 years. Michigan looks sort of like the U.S., except throughout the income distribution, we haven't done as well. In other words, the middle class in Michigan has done very poorly, really have no growth in 40 years. And the 10th percentile, 20th percentile, 30th percentile, the lower middle class, the poor, have gone nowhere. But if you get above the middle in Michigan, you have seen growth. And if you're way toward the top in Michigan, very substantial growth. So we sort of mirror the U.S. as a whole, although the top hasn't done as well in Michigan as in many other parts of the country. And the middle especially has not done nearly as well as in some other parts of the country. I would say that for the middle class in the last 40 years, for the U.S. as a whole, it's sort of mediocre. For Michigan,
it's gone up, but just
gone up,
very
but not by
little.
Much. Exactly. Okay. Gone up, but not by much, and not by nearly as much as at the top. And then in Michigan, the middle class, actually, we calculated, where are you in 2013 relative to 1976, adjusting for inflation? The middle of the income distribution has made no gains.
Did you look into why these discrepancies became broader?
A big part of it is that different education groups have done very differently. High school dropouts, but even those who have a high school diploma have seen declining real incomes. If you've got a bachelor's degree, you've seen halfway decent growth, and the bachelor's in Michigan, about between 25% and 30% of the adult population has a bachelor's degree. And then the group that has done the best of all, by far, is those who have education beyond a bachelor's, an MBA, a law degree, a doctor's degree, that sort of thing. Another factor is the decline of unions. Unions, for a few decades in the middle of the 20th century really helped to support the incomes of sort of lower middle income and middle income workers. But unions have been losing strength for really since the 1950s.
Was deregulation an issue here, as far as you're concerned? You did look at the causes, though.
We were mostly just measuring and looking at the differences, but we did also look at some of the causes. Mm. One of the big stories, it's not so much a story for hurting the middle class, but it's a story for helping those at the very top, is the deregulation of financial services. Mm. The deregulation of Wall Street, the big banks, the investment banks, has transferred literally trillions to a relatively small number of people. And that also paved the way for the Great Recession, for the financial crisis that hit 7 years ago next week.
You would say then that this topic is rightfully a part of the debate leading up to the presidential election?
Oh, I would absolutely say. I mean, in my view, you can make the argument that the increase in income inequality is the biggest economic story of our lifetime. Mm. It is, at least in substantial part, it is the result of policy changes. I mean, it didn't just happen. It is at least in part the result of policies. We have a much less progressive tax system than we used to have. We deregulated financial services, and that really spurred the inequality. Education support hasn't kept up with the demands for highly skilled workers. So it is a big issue, and I think it would be appropriate those seeking public office to have to address it.
Mm-hmm. MSU economics professor Charlie Ballard is our guest. We're talking about some of Charlie's recent work exploring the income distribution here in Michigan. You focused on the years 1976 to 2013.
That's right.
Okay, so it included the Great Recession.
Uh-huh.
Another education point here. Early childhood education seems to be, there seems to be a consensus that we need to invest more in that and that we are investing more in that. Did that come out in any way in your work?
Well, I'm a big supporter of improved support for early childhood education. I don't think that there's only an indirect connection between this research work and that. All of the evidence is that those who have the more skills are going to do better, not just in terms of their earnings in the labor market, but also they're going to have fewer teenage pregnancies, they're going to have less crime, all sorts of better indicators. And the thing that plays a bigger role in that than any other thing is the early childhood. And I think I'm critical of the lack of support for education in many places in Michigan and in the United States, but I really applaud our legislature and Governor Snyder for increasing the number of spaces available for early childhood education, because that is an investment that earns a terrific rate of return for society. That rate of return, we won't see it for years, because, you know, today's four-year-olds, they won't be in the labor market for
right.
a while, but it is, the historical evidence is that it really has a big effect.
Your data coexists with some amount of encouraging economic news, at least recently. Unemployment down, inflation amazingly low for years now, a broad rebound in manufacturing, including here in Michigan. Assuming you're right about this broader trend, have middle and lower class workers made up any ground recently?
Yes. The worst, of course, was 2009 and 2010. And we've seen in Michigan, the unemployment rate peaked at higher than 14%. It's now down not much above 5%. And so we have made some progress, but that's against the background of the previous decade being really, really pretty rough. And even with the improved employment, there are an awful lot of folks who aren't seeing the kind of wages that I would like them to see. The wages have been stagnant, barely keeping up with inflation for a very large portion of the population, especially the sort of the middle and lower income strata. And as a result, that means that even with this rebound from the Great Recession, we haven't had a turnaround in the income inequality. In fact, in Michigan, the income inequality actually grew in the 5 years after the Great Recession. Mm. It continued to grow because the middle class did sort of so-so. Their wages barely kept up with inflation, but those at the top did even relatively better.
Care to speculate at all on the possible impact of right to work on income distribution? That's a pretty speculative question. But
My sense is that right to work really has had very little effect. But that's not because because it's irrelevant. It's just because unions had lost so much ground in previous decades that, in a sense, we already had right to work before that law was passed almost 3 years ago. The fraction of the Michigan workforce that is a member of a union used to be 45% in 1964, which is the earliest year for which we have good data on it. Now it's down below 20%. And in fact, in the private sector, it's below 10%. So unions are, for better or worse, much weaker. And I don't see any evidence that the right to work law of a couple of years ago has had any further effect, because the unions were already pretty weak.
I want to bring up a study released last year by sociologists from Cornell and Washington University, last names Herschel and Rank. They used government data, and the results of their work suggest that there is great fluidity in the U.S. economy, that many Americans over a period of decades are apt to spend a year or some number of years in poverty at some time in their lives, but they often manage to rise out of it. And to be sure, it works in the opposite direction as well. Fortune magazine commentator Chris Matthews, not the Chris Matthews, but this Chris Matthews, theorized that this is why income inequality is failing to resonate more as an issue, because quite a few Americans have faith that they can escape whatever their economic circumstances are at the moment, that people who are in poverty may have been affluent at one point, and they have confidence they can get out of whatever financial straits there are. What do you make of that fluidity argument? Is that present?
That is, and but there is a gap between the perception and the reality. A study by Alberto Alessina and Edward Glazer showed that the amount of economic mobility in the United States is really not that great. Mm. And in fact, Gary Solon, who's just recently moved from Michigan State to University of Arizona, is sort of the world's leading expert on this. And he finds the degree of mobility is modest. Yes, it is true. You can certainly tell stories about individuals who were in poverty and came out of it, and also individuals who were rich and then had a turn for the worse. But the overall degree of mobility is not huge. But the American myth is of huge mobility. Rags to riches, pull yourself up by
durable,
your bootstraps.
A durable myth.
It's a durable myth. And that explains one of the differences between us and Europe. The degree of actual mobility is very similar. But the Americans have the myth of mobility, and the Europeans do not. And that's one of the reasons why the Europeans have a stronger social safety net.
We're down to 30 seconds. I was hoping we'd have more time for this, but speaking of Europe, you're just back from Italy where you traveled. You rubbed shoulders with, well, you don't rub shoulders with the MSU men's basketball team when you're not 6'8", but you did hang out with the basketball team. How did that unfold?
Mark Hollis, MSU's athletic director, gets the credit for this idea that we wanted them to have the opportunity to play against these top-flight European competition, but also to have it be an academic experience. So I crafted a one-credit course. We had some classroom meetings before we went, and then I accompanied the team and provided commentary, and it was a great experience.
Charlie Ballard is a professor of economics at Michigan State University. We've been talking about income inequality and the trends around income inequality specifically here in Michigan. It's been the focus of some of Professor Ballard's recent work. Good to see you, Charlie. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Mark.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mark Bayshore. Greater Lansing has developed a robust local food movement in recent years. Urban gardens have sprouted up across the city, taking the place of vacant lots or unused green space. And now the region boasts over 20 different farmers markets across 14 cities. A new exhibit at the Micah Gallery in Old Town explores Lansing's local food culture through art. Current State's April Van Buren visited the gallery for the show's opening, which combined visual art and music with the culinary world.
To begin, Blurred by Bill Ryan.
At the opening of the new Curating Roots exhibit, there was a little something for each of your five senses. As the crowd wandered about looking at the art hanging on the walls, the air filled with the rich sound of marimbas and the smell of hors d'oeuvres wafted into the gallery from the back of the room. This newest exhibit at the Michigan Institute for Contemporary Art looks at the local food movement in Lansing. Katrina Daniels is the program director for MICA, and I met up with her as she was setting up for the opening. She says she wanted Curating Roots to celebrate what's unique and positive about Lansing.
We have this really rich local food movement here, and it's not only the urban farms, but the farmers markets and all of these wonderful nonprofits that come together to make this just really interesting, unique aspect of our city.
Lining the walls are photographs of local farms and paintings of produce piled high. Katrina shows me to one of her favorite pieces. It's part of a series of photographs about the Lansing Roots Program, a nonprofit farm incubator that caters to aspiring refugee and low-income farmers.
This one in particular, this is actually a mother and child, and they are sitting in a field in the farm, and they are digging up and holding fresh beets in their hands, and they're connecting with each other, they're smiling, they're sitting in the sunshine and holding this beautiful fresh produce. And I love it. It's still covered in dirt, it still has the tops on it, you know, and it's this something that's really the harvest of their hard work.
The photographs by artist Dave Trumpy were one of the first submissions, and Katrina says she built the whole exhibit around them. As you move to the center of the gallery, you'll see a table laid out with eight different place settings. Forks and spoons, cups and plates. Each set was crafted by a different artist, and they range from a cup that looks like it was made of lettuce to more traditional and abstract designs. Katrina says she wanted the table to create a physical connection between the ideas of food and community.
This idea of having a dinner party that shows different play settings from different artists, they're all unique, they all are extremely different from one another, but it's set to build this table. And there's just something so primal about sitting down and breaking bread with another person, and I really wanted that to be shown here in the exhibit as well.
It's not just that food makes a ripe subject for art, it's that food can be art as well. You don't have to go to a gallery, Katrina says, just head to your local farmer's market.
You know, a lot of people, I think, sort of look at food in the, you know, supermarket, and it's prepackaged, and it's sort of homogeneous, and it looks very similar. But really, when you go to the farmers markets, and you're seeing these peppermint beets and the garlic scapes and this beautiful food, and it's a completely different experience.
Chelsea Kogiatic is a PhD student at the MSU College of Music. She says she also draws inspiration from the local food movement for her own art. Chelsea had already been looking for a way to combine music with the culinary world before Katrina Daniels put out a call for work to feature in the exhibit.
And so I called Katrina and I said, I need to meet with you because I have a music thing that has to do with food. You have an art thing that has to do with food. There's got to be a way to put it all together.
For this evening's performance, Chelsea chose pieces of music for percussion and wind instruments. Partly she was working within the space constraints of the gallery, but the music was also chosen to accompany the evening's food. So instead of a wine pairing, a music pairing.
Here's the thing, in music, we find composers inspired by text, by poetry, by speeches sometimes, and we'll find artists who want to paint based on music. And I knew that culinary skills, it's something that's very important, but we don't always treat it like an art form, and it is. So I wanted these creative chefs to use their creativity that they may be denied in the restaurant atmosphere and create something that is inspired by music.
Keith Buckley was the man behind the food for the evening. He's the general manager for the Lansing restaurant Soup Spoon, and he says that he tried to let the music Chelsea chose shape the dishes he created.
All good food has a story. So I took the story that the music that I heard in the music, or the elements that I got from it, and then tried to create a dish that would go along with it, but also something that I'd never done before and I'd never seen done before.
Keith shows me the dish he's laid out to go with the first song of the evening. As he places marshmallow clouds onto small plates, Keith tells me he knew exactly what he wanted to do when he first heard this piece of music. The rich tones of the marimba reminded him of cloudy days and raindrops falling in the woods.
So I wanted to do, marshmallows were perfect in my idea, but to get a marshmallow that's not super sweet. So these are savory marshmallows. They're savory marshmallows with rosemary. So for me anyway, this scent of rain and storms always associates with the outdoors very closely. So the woods, things like that. And rosemary has that very earthy element to it.
Keith topped the marshmallows with a jelly made from Madeira, which is a fortified wine from Portugal.
And this particular type of Madeira I'm using is called rainwater Madeira. And it was Madeira that was an accident. So it was left by accident on the docks one day and during a rainstorm, and the barrels got inundated with water. And a very enterprising wine merchant decided to label this as rainwater Madeira to the US audience.
And to top it off, a little bit of bacon. For Keith, the challenge wasn't coming up with creative ways to interpret the music. It was limiting himself to just one dish.
Everything that I heard was brilliant. I wanted to do a whole dinner based on every song.
MICA curator Katrina Daniels says she hopes tonight's opening gives people an immersive experience of the local food movement. And while this is a one-time event, she's also lined up a full calendar of programming over the next 2 months, including a film screening and panel discussion, as well as a modern dance performance. She hopes the diverse programming will help visitors to the gallery develop a more personal sense of where their food comes from.
And I firmly believe that art is just this wonderful opportunity for starting a conversation. It's really the perfect platform to start a conversation with our community, and it's okay if the exhibit is finite and it's here for a limited period of time, because if this takes off and other people can explore this idea on their own, then we've done our job.
Another goal of Katrina's is to make contemporary art a little less intimidating.
I see people come in, or I see sometimes people just press their faces up against the glass and kind of peek in, and often feel quite nervous. You know, well, I don't know a lot about art, or do I have to buy something when I come in?
Katrina says she hopes this exhibit might convince some of those people to actually come into the gallery.
It's such an easy work to connect with, because we all eat. Food is the most primal, you know, need for us. And community, that's something that we can all get around and understand. So I'm hoping that this will offer the community an opportunity to see contemporary art as something that's accessible, that they can enjoy, and they can interact with in different ways.
You can see Curating Roots, the Art of the Local Food Movement in Lansing, at the Michigan Institute for Contemporary Art in Old Town. The exhibit runs through the end of October. For Current State, this is April Van Buren.
And coming up on Current State, for 17 years, the Meridian Township Police Department has invited those it serves to get an up-close look at day-to-day life behind the thin blue line. The township's Citizens Academy is an outreach tool that both officers and participants say pays dividends in trust. Current State's Kevin Lavery previews this year's session. Plus, a new book review from Scott Southard and one of the storytellers from Current State's very first pop-up stories event at the Allen Neighborhood Center. Last night, you'll hear that account. That and more coming up after the break.
Songs drifted to the streets of the house of princes. A wind rose up and blew the clouds back home to rest. We gather in the garden in the midday heat, in the house of princes. A silhouette of Jerusalem's sage danced like a drunken guest in the house of princes. With two candles in a twine.
Longtime Lansing musician and finalist on NBC TV's The Voice, Joshua Davis, there singing House of Princes for us on a Current State Live Music Friday earlier this summer. Tomorrow, local singer-songwriter Alex Mendenhall joins us in Studio S. We'll talk with him about his experience with the Lansing band Coolidge and about striking out on his own as well. Hope you can join us. That is tomorrow and every Friday here on Current State. Well, sequels can mean big money for the authors of popular books, even more so if they make it to the big screen. But now there's another genre of follow-ups to novels that's becoming popular. Our book reviewer Scott Southard tells us more in his review of Another Day by David Levithan.
There's a weird new trend I've noticed creeping into the literary world. I'm not sure if there's a word for it yet, but I'm sure publishers are seeing its financial potential. But while publishers and authors might be cashing in, readers aren't so lucky. You might call these books companion books. They are not sequels per se, but instead a mirror of the same book, telling the same story from another character's perspective. E.L. James did it with her 50 Shades of Grey series, retelling the first novel from the perspective of her male lead. Stephanie Meyer almost did it with Twilight. It's a trend that makes up a big part of the world of fan fiction, but now the mainstream is catching on. Recently, young adult author David Levithan has done it, showing us a different side of his wonderful 2013 young adult novel, Every Day. Every Day is the story of a character named A. Each morning, A wakes up in a different body, a different life. Using only memories and instincts, A has to survive through the day until he falls asleep and the cycle begins again. Levithan takes this wonderful concept and plays it perfectly in Every Day. He uses each new morning as an opportunity to take on young adult issues like depression, addiction, and bullying. I don't say this lightly, but I think that every 16-year-old should be handed a copy on their birthday. It is that good. Well, A and the other characters of Every Day are back. While this new book is called Another Day, it is anything but that. A better name might be Same Day. This book follows the exact plot of Every Day, but retold through the eyes of A's love interest, Rhiannon. As a fan of the first book, I was really hoping for a sequel that moved the plot forward and added to the story. I was, unfortunately, sorely disappointed. The thing is that these books seem lazy to me. It feels like the authors just copy and pasted the first book into a new manuscript. Yes, they might give us one or two little snippets of new information, but we as readers are experiencing the same dialogue and jokes, the same interactions, and the same plot. All that has been locked in by the previous book, so it can't be changed. For example, in Every Day, we had to deal with Rhiannon's relationship to her obnoxious and angry boyfriend, Justin. It was a weak moment in an otherwise great book. I can't imagine any young adult reader cheering for more time with Justin. But in Another Day, we get to experience it all over again. David Levithan is a wonderful and creative writer, which makes this book an even bigger letdown. It's hard to tell someone with so much talent that they made a mistake. But David, I've got to say, you're better than this. Another Day feels like finding supplemental material on a movie DVD. Maybe it could have worked as a little short story, but did you have to write a full book? So what is next, literary world? Telling the Harry Potter series through the eyes of Ron? The Hound of the Baskervilles from the perspective of the dog? How about The Great Gatsby as told by Daisy? Mr. Darcy's take on Pride and Prejudice? I could complain more, but I'm not sure the publishers would hear me over the cha-ching of those cash registers. For Current State, this is Scott Southard.
Scott Southard is the author of the new novel Permanent Spring Showers and A Jane Austen Daydream. You can follow his writings via his blog, The Musings and Artful Blunders of Scott D. Southard. That's at sdsouthard.com. Well, the image of a uniformed police officer or even a police patrol car can evoke a range of emotions, both positive and negative. Over the past year, the tensions that have flared in various communities across the country have forced police departments to work even harder to earn the trust of the publics they serve. Fostering good relationships is vital for any law enforcement agency. This week, the Meridian Township Police Department is beginning its annual Citizens Academy as part of its outreach mission. Current State's Kevin Lavery joins me now. Kevin, this is a long-established program in the township, right?
Yes, it is, Mark. This is the 17th year of the program, which will meet every Thursday from today through November 5th. The Academy strives to answer a lot of questions, from what do police officers do every day on patrol to how are forensic investigations conducted. So I wanted to learn more about this myself, so I spoke with Meridian Township Police Lieutenant Greg Frenger, who told me that the Academy is not the only avenue the police have to connect with their citizens.
We have many different levels of community leaders and neighborhood watches, and we meet with those folks on a regular basis. Our officers have communities assigned to them, so a particular subdivision or neighborhood would be assigned to an officer, and they liaise with that leader from that neighborhood to keep them up to date on information, problems in their neighborhood. It's a two-way exchange of information, and update them on potentially on problems that we foresee in the future.
Now, I've looked at the list of topics that are covered, and it's pretty standard stuff. It's a lot of procedure. It's very lecture-oriented. But to what degree is it hands-on, and to what degree do the citizens get even just a little taste of what policing is?
Through the course of the academy, we do try and do the hands-on work, and we find that the hands-on activities, the interaction in those ways, is much more rewarding for the participants than just a straight-up, you know, lecture with a PowerPoint. And so people bring in their equipment and allow the participants to handle it. We get them in a patrol car and have them look at that equipment. When they complete the academy, they're invited to ride along on a shift with our patrol officers. And so there is as much hands-on as we can get, but it does become more of a face-to-face interaction and communication with experienced people doing the work now in the field and sharing personal experience and discussing the outcomes of those cases that they work.
And how do you think that has made perhaps you personally and the people in your department better police officers?
Well, as police officers, we're social people. But sometimes a lot of our interaction on duty is not positive interaction with solid citizens. If we work midnights, we tend to have a lot of interaction with people who are in trouble or having trouble. And so we don't see a lot of our citizens in the best light, and that becomes a doldrum, an experience that is ongoing. And so sometimes it can be a negative for us to not see the light of day and see the opposite side of police work, which is that community interaction, that positive interaction. The people that appreciate us and aren't in dire need for an emergency but want to have this two-way communication.
We're talking with Lieutenant Greg Frenger, who is with the Meridian Township Police Department. We're talking about the start of this season's Meridian Township Citizens Police Academy. What resonates the most with people who go through the academy?
Well, CSI shows and those sorts of things are very popular these days. That part of the academy is always a big hit with the attendees.
Do they learn that it's interesting, but it's not quite what they see on TV?
They do learn that it's interesting and that it isn't all concluded within the 10 minutes or 5 minutes of the episode that they watch. And the reality of the actual work that's done is a little longer, but also the reality of the constraints of that data and the evidence that we collect. The negative thing that I sometimes see is sometimes juries and citizens expect that sort of CSI factor in every case that we do, and it's not always there. We don't always find evidence or collect evidence that will lead to an actual conclusion of a case. If we can, we schedule a hands-on activity where the participants go through a shooting simulator, and they're basically before the screen and as you've probably seen on TV, simulating addressing or answering a typical call for service and whether to use force or whether not to use force. And so there are certainly those instances where they do or should use some sort of force, but then there are others where it escalates and then it quickly de-escalates, and they see the difference between those types of incidents and how quickly things can A, go wrong, and how quickly they also B, have to de-escalate from things going poorly.
When you get some of that feedback from people who go through the academy, when they get to that part of the training, do they have some surprising things to say about shoot versus don't shoot scenarios and the quick decision process that you have to make?
Yes, they do. They recognize that these things develop quickly. Sometimes there's no warning, and we've seen that in the news lately where officers are responding to very innocuous types of calls, and things go horribly bad from there. And so they see that sort of thing and how it develops, but they also get a sense of the dynamics of the effect of the stress on them as a participant. Even though it's not real life, it does become very engaging, and they feel some of those stressors and understand a little bit better some of the dynamics behind these use of force incidents and maybe the criticisms that you see of use of force. There's a few guest speakers that come in, and one is Dr. Gallagher, who does some of our pre-screening for candidates for police officers.
And just to be clear, you're talking about Dr. Jerry Gallagher, a psychologist who practices in Okemos?
Yes, and looks at their personality traits and helps us determine if they're a good candidate for law enforcement.
We're talking with Lieutenant Greg Frenger with the Meridian Township Police Department. We're talking about the start of this fall's Citizens Police Academy in Meridian Township. We have seen, certainly across the country in the last year, some very strained police and community relations, to say the least. And I'm wondering if you feel that trust is something that is assumed first, or is it earned first?
Well, I think we need to earn trust, and it is being eroded, I think, in the media and the way things sometimes are portrayed. You have to understand that when a lot of these things happen, the law enforcement end cannot always disclose all the information that would maybe give a different perception of the way things were handled or the entire incident. Because we still, it's early on usually in an investigation, and we still don't know all the facts. And even if we know some interesting facts that may tip the scales in our favor as far as public opinion, we may be restricted from sharing that information because there's still litigation pending. There's still a criminal case and potential civil case. And you always hear the term trying a case in the media. We can't always disclose the information that would sway people's opinion to the media early on in an investigation, because we want to vet the information, but also because there's restrictions placed on us by the prosecutor's office on what we disclose.
Police departments across the country are always facing budget situations. Hiring and retention is always an issue across the country. I imagine it probably is here in Meridian Township to some degree. Does that information come across in these citizen police academies? Do people have a sense of what types of resources and funding challenges that you're up against?
Yes, we don't dwell on that. Some of that can be seen as politicizing and trying to drum up that kind of support. But when you talk about funding and resources available to agencies today, there's always a lag between market changes and the availability of funds for local government. And so when the market does poorly and housing especially crashes, we see an impact, and it's relatively quick as far as the tax revenue seeing a change in our funding. But then it lingers because the housing market does not necessarily bounce back overnight, and so that tax revenue remains dwindling or consistently low while we're still suffering the same sort of challenges as far as workload and personnel issues. And so you may see now that the market is doing well, but we're still not funded as well as we would like. We have to focus on the important parts of our job and funding those things that we must do. And certainly staffing our patrol is very important. But we want to continue training and keep our personnel well-trained and well-educated and do all these other things that in the end, it all costs money.
Do you ever get to enjoy an aha moment when you see someone who's going through the Citizens Police Academy understand something or get some insight about something that just they hadn't realized before that just clicks?
Absolutely. I think, you know, sometimes there are participants that come that may not have a very positive image of law enforcement, and you start to see maybe their opinion change over time. And there's a lot of aha moments when it comes to one of our most common interactions, which is traffic stops. And we explain why we do certain things when we make a traffic stop and why we approach the way we do, and the use of all the lights and so forth, and the training that goes into that. And you do see some folks that say, well, I had, you know, a negative experience and here's why. And you start to understand through what they tell you what bothered them and try and respond to or explain why things were done a certain way. And then they start to understand it. They may not agree with it. They may not fully appreciate it, and they may not get it completely, but there are those times where you see people that understand much better why we do some of the things we do. And yeah, it is that sort of aha. And it is a good feeling to see that maybe something that has festered with a person for a long time and given them a bad perception of, you know, either our department or another law enforcement agency, that maybe now they understand it a little better and they appreciate it.
Greg Frenger is a lieutenant on the Meridian Township Police Department. We've been talking about the Citizens Police Academy being conducted this month and running through November. Lieutenant Frenger, thanks so much for your time and best of luck with the program.
Thank you.
For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
And we want to thank all of you who came out to Current State's very first pop-up stories event at Lansing's Allen Neighborhood Center last evening. We had great weather and a great lineup of stories about being hungry and fed. Deidre Humphreys was one of the storytellers who took the stage last night, and she shared her story about being hungry for Dragon Boat Gold.
So a couple of weeks ago, we went to race at Lake Orion. It's a festival called Dragon in the Lake. Dragon on the Lake in northern Oakland County. And we had been to this race 2 years before and got in third. And so as we went into our winter training last year, it was all about getting our mindset that we were going to win first place at Lake Orion. And so all the time that we're lifting weights and punching the bag, we're thinking about gold, and my red-haired Russian teammate, Alona, all she could say was, next time we will crush them. So this is the mindset. Now, I don't tend to think that way. I just try to take things as they come. So we land in Lake Orion in the athletes' camp on August the 30th, and we're getting ready for our race. There are two qualifying heats and the final. So I look on the roster, and the coach has put the roster together for all three races, and he's got me paddling on the right. Now, the way that you paddle in a dragon boat, you only paddle one side. So on the right means that my left hand would be up, and my right hand is on the bottom. So if this is, you know, the top, it's like this, and you drag the paddle back through the water. Well, I'm right-handed, so my right side is stronger than my left side. But in order to paddle, I got to turn like this, so this is my weak side. I'm not all that happy about it, but I don't say anything because I'm a good crew member. So we go out in the boat and paddle up to the line, and what they call is paddlers, are you ready? And that's when you put your paddle in and you listen for the horn. And we paddle, and I cannot keep a hold to this paddle. It is so fast out there. And I'm struggling, really, seriously. I'm struggling with this paddle. So we finish the race, and we go back, and we get in our huddle with Rob. And he asks, how's it going, and how did it go? And I do like this. And he looks at me, and he says, why did you pull your paddle? And that means I took my paddle out. And I'm like, I didn't mean to. I lost control of the paddle, but I am so mortified that my coach hollered at me in front of everybody else, and even more mortified because we won the race without me. Without, you know, that's a terrible feeling when you're not on a, when you're on a team and you don't feel like you're contributing, right? So we get 2 hours between races. So the whole time for the 2 hours, I'm practicing the stroke. You know, I gotta get this because I'm on the right side for the second heat as well. So I'm practicing. People come over and help me, and the coach does, you know. And I say to Rob, I say, you know, I just don't want to be the weak sister on the team. And he says, well, you're not. So, you know, just keep paddling. So we go back out, and on the way, I get some of this wax that you can put on the paddle, and it helps your hand grip better, sort of like a super glue. So I can keep my hands on the paddle and keep my paddle in the water. And we run the race, and I keep in sync with my teammates because that's how you get the boat to go fast. And we finish the race, and we win that heat as well. So we did it in, it's 300 meters, and we did the first race in a minute 20 seconds, and that second race we did in a minute 19 seconds. So we're getting better. We cut a whole second, and that's huge in racing. Okay, so we go back, and now it's 2 hours before the final. We're in the final. We're seated number one. Now, how do you get to number one? How do you get there? So what I've learned in being on the team is that to be a winner, you know, you have to be consistent, you have to be persistent, and don't let distractions take your attention away from what you're doing. And one of those distractions can be weather. So I remember this one practice when we went out, I went to practice, and it was overcast, but much worse than what we're looking at today. And when we started to get in the ball, it starts pouring. I mean, it's pouring exclamation points all on my shoulders. And I usually, you know, I'm going the house when it's raining, but the coach says load the boat. And so we have to go out there and practice. And after a while, I don't even, you know, notice it. And I kind of miss the rain when it goes away. So now we're headed out for the final. We paddle out to the starting line, and we have a few minutes because the other two boats have to get out there. And I'm nervous. Rob has switched me to the left side, thank God, but I'm still nervous. This is the final, right? And the sky is looking all angry, making faces at us, and I have to remember, focus, you know, get my attention in the boat, get my head in the boat. So I bring my eyes down, and I'm looking down the center of the boat, and I can see my teammates' shoulders, and I'm like, okay, and I'm looking down at the surface, and then, don't you know, I see that the surface of the lake starts to get holes in it, and it starts to rain, and it starts to rain on my head, and I think, I bet these other teams don't know how to paddle in the rain, but we do. We got this. And I'm telling you this story because we won. We got first place at Lake Orion and a gold medal. So I guess that's the moral of the story is, you know, to hang in there and be a winner. So thank you so much for listening to my story.
And our next pop-up stories event is just around the corner at the East Lansing Public Library. If you have a story that you'd like to tell, keep it right here. We'll have more information on that for you. You can also see that on our Facebook page, Current State at WKAR on Facebook. And that's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow, 9/11, back in 2001, Dr. Antonio Dyer worked in a hospital emergency room 5 blocks from the World Trade Center. That July, his team held a mass casualty drill to prepare for the unthinkable, a nightmare no one expected to come true. just 2 months later. While he's here in Lansing, we'll talk with Dr. Dyer about his memories of being on the front lines during the 9/11 tragedy. Plus, local singer-songwriter Alex Mendenhall will be in Studio S for our next Live Music Friday. That and more tomorrow here on Current State. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. April Van Buren directed our show today. Thanks also to Melissa Benmark, Scott Pohl, Kevin Lavery, Jamie Paisley, Katie Cook, and Drew Hill. Current State can come to your smartphone every day. Just subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you retrieve your podcasts. You can also find us on social media at KAR Current State on Twitter and on Facebook. Again, Current State from WKAR.org. Have a wonderful day. We'll be looking for you Friday on a Live Music Friday. It's Current State on WKAR.